is call a vote to everybody for coming out tonight. I think a regular Tuesday night is challenging to get out. I see quite a few faces in the room that were here with us last night, so two nights in a row for many people, and I'm sure there are others for whom it's two nights in a row that I'm even not aware of. But certainly following Atanas and the needs of our families at home, it's not so easy to be here. Scheduling these nights was quite challenging in the overall HALB community calendar, and we appreciate everyone's efforts to join us. This is actually a new endeavor, something which really excited to have been honestly pushed, inspired by the SK Parent Council, by a subcommittee of our Parent Council, a Parent Education Committee, to really try to expand our offerings to the HALB parent body, those in our high school, and I see many parents from our elementary school, from DRS, and even from outside the greater community. It's a pleasure to welcome everybody. It's actually something which I have been proud to be a part of over the last many years, and something which I think is really special in our school, just starting from the lay leadership and the incredible amount of parent involvement and commitment that we have to everything that we do, and certainly to our parents' interest and desire to continue to learn themselves. And whether it's last night we had a night to learn about ways that we can support our children in the big, wide, vast world that we have, in terms of things that are out there, outside of what we would hope to be our insular walls. And if it's that type of education, or if it's just Torah education, so that we can continue to be inspired to inspire our children, that's honestly what I think is one of the most special things about our HALB community, and something that I'm tremendously proud to be associated with. Tonight is actually the first of a three-part series. No, you're not locked into coming to all three parts, but I do want to say that all three parts are actually very distinctly different, but they have been coordinated to really build a full picture on the challenging topic of tefillah. So tonight I'll be presenting. Next week we have the opportunity to hear from Dr. Jay Goldmans. Those of you who are not familiar with who Rabbi Dr. Goldmans is, he's the former headmaster of Ramaz. He's really extremely well-respected educator. His doctoral thesis was actually on tefillah education, what that looks like both formally and informally. He currently, in addition to teaching in his semi-retired stage in various schools, he actually gives a course in Azrieli's doctoral program and master's program on teaching tefillah. And I think the way he's probably most well-known is that he's the author of the first of the Koran Siddurim to come out in the last few years for children. He authored the Siddur for teenagers and adolescents. His commentary, his observations, his scientific study of what it means to educate children in tefillah formally and informally, as I said, what an age of maturation is, you know, what that should look like. What should a six-year-old davening, what can we expect from a six-year-old, what can we expect from a 16-year-old? What can we expect from a 16-year-old in 2018, and how might that be different than the way that we davened when we were 16? All with a lot of thoughtful thought, but with a deep sense of Yirat Shamayim and commitment to trying to inspire tefillah. So he's our next speaker. And the third in the series is actually something which we're also super excited about. The presenters are going to be largely our SK students. They're going to be sharing things that they have learned and experienced in school through our tefillah education programs with their parents. And believe it or not, this is really not at their request. In fact, they're quaking in their boots. They keep saying, maybe ask somebody else. We're not really sure we want to do that. Are you sure? What are we going to say? Etc. Trust me, they have a lot to say. But it really came from parents who said, you know, my kid came home talking about this, or I saw this post-it note in her sitter, like, what is that? Can I get one? And things like that. And I think it's things that would be actually really interesting to parents as well. So that's the series. Tonight is actually being sponsored by Suri Khan and family and Chama Strauss and family. We thank them very much for helping make this evening happen. And we are looking for sponsors for the other evenings if anybody would like to join us in this endeavor. So on to tonight. So I guess I'm lucky. I can title my and put myself in this series where I want to be. I gave myself a catch-all title of The Challenges of Tefillah. And it is a catch-all title, I think that it encompasses a lot because there are a lot of challenges in the area of tefillah. And frankly, there are challenges, I believe, to really all of the constituents who involved themselves in tefillah. Just last night, at our program here in school for 10th grade parents, there was a reference made to a shul in Teaneck, Congregation Beth Aaron, and its rabbi, Rabbi Larry Rothwax, who held 2 weeks ago a town hall meeting in shul about the problem of talking in shul, and along with it, some other problems that came with it about things that happened at Kiddushim, and whether or not we should be alcohol-free or not. But one of the big topics that went on at that particular event was just an open discussion and an open forum of what can we do about the problem called talking in shul. It's not like adults have this tefillah thing figured out exactly right, or down pat in our communal davening. And I think we all recognize that it's something which plagues us in that particular area. Among schools and among educators, there is not a forum that I have ever been a part of, whether it's an online educators chat, whether it's a large conference, whether it's a small conference, whether it's an SKA teachers meeting, where the problem called tefillah has not come up. Its only second is to dress code, very honestly. And I don't mean that here in SKA. I mean that at any place I've been. I've been a representative of High School Girls Administration and at Torah Mesorah, where I am by far the most open-minded school. My cohorts are wearing two head coverings, Hasidish women. They're all talking about dress code and the problem called tefillah. And the same thing is true in co-ed schools, across Solomon Schechter's. It really doesn't matter. We are living in a world where people are really finding tefillah education and tefillah in general to be very challenging. I think at home as parents, we're struck by this. What do we do on a Sunday morning? Do we force a child to go to shul? How much do you have to daven? You know, reminding your child to daven, I did. Really? What does that mean? What do I do? What do I say? Right? What does davening look like in our homes? And again, I don't mean that in a critical way. I just mean that in a question mark way. You know, do we have thoughtful ideologies, thoughts, pedagogic principles that go into what davening looks like in our home? And I'm going to be sharing tonight, honestly, some personal challenges, challenges that I have found personally when it comes to tefillah. I think, honestly, I'm not such a public personality, but I think I'm comfortable sharing those because I don't believe I'm unique, and I think that what I share is going to be things that resonate with each and every one of us on a personal level. When it comes to trying to figure out, you know, why we have all of these challenges, so I think there are things which are very obvious, and I'm not looking to dwell upon them at great length tonight. I'll be honest, any one of the things that I'm going to mention is something which we could dedicate a full hour, if not multiple hours, to discussing. But I think for a long time, or maybe at first glance, people feel that the challenge with tefillah is that we are for the most part, I imagine the people in this room, like myself, we're not native Hebrew speakers. We're speaking, you know, another language. It's kind of like, you know, taking your phone, putting something into Google Translate. The phone speaks it in Spanish. I could speak it. I don't really connect to what I'm saying. Thank God I don't have to be passionate about what I'm saying. I just need to get the instruction translated to somebody who speaks another language. But since it's not my language, it's hard to feel connection to something like that. The truth is, I think for a long time, people felt that that was the problem called tefillah. Art Scroll, 40 years ago, you know, really did a tremendous service to our world and our community, and they made enormous contributions to tefillah. But the reality is that I don't think we're light years ahead of where we were at that time, and that the problem is much more than just get an English sitter, know what you're saying, say it in English. I think that most of us are uninhibited to do that. And still, that's not necessarily bringing great meaning and connection for us or for our children. I do think that, as I mentioned a minute ago, and Dr. Goldman's has documented a lot of this, that we live in a world where focus and attention is harder and harder to come by. You know, sitting, and I see this for sure, I see it in school, it's much harder for people to sit through davening is so long, 15 minutes, right? Kriyas HaTorah was my own children, right? It was really long today, right? Okay. Really long HaTorah, I couldn't sit, right? And these are not things I think that really were as prevalent in times, even 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And some of it is because we're just stimulated by so many things. And the reality is the sitter is not always so stimulating. Shul is not always so stimulating. There aren't a lot of sounds and noises and lights and different things to look at. And in that way, I think we really are challenged by tefillah. I actually really believe and have some sympathy for tefillah being boring for people today, because by comparison, it does pale. And again, I think it doesn't have to be boring. I want to be clear about that. But I understand why at first glance that is certainly a reaction. And I'd also just like to, at the outset, just give a nod to one other thing, which is deeper, honestly, and also something which we could dedicate hours and hours to, in my opinion, which we won't do tonight, but I do think needs to be acknowledged, that if you look at anything from Mamre Chazal on Tefillah to the example in Tanakh of Chana and her amazing connection to the Rabbeinu Sholem through Tefillah, to studies today in social science, to reading a book, Lahavdil, like Brené Brown's Daring Greatly about vulnerability, there is a tremendous connection between being in touch with one's vulnerability, with feeling vulnerable, with acknowledging weakness, and with connecting meaningfully towards tefillah. And we live in a world where our weaknesses are quickly pushed aside. You're not going to post that picture because it's not your best, and you're not going to. You have a great a dish that you made, and you want to post it, but your kitchen looks a mess, so you can't possibly do that. Any of our more superficial vulnerabilities or our deeper vulnerabilities, we live in a world that doesn't really encourage us to feel those things always at all times. And if we don't feel vulnerable, so again, the Torah tells us in Sefer Devarim, this is going to be part of the Gullus experience. You're going to say, Kochi va'otzem yadi. You're going to always be focusing on your strengths and your victories, and everything's great and everything's terrific, and I'm going to have to constantly be projecting that to myself and to the world. And therefore, it's going to be hard to ever feel that you need the Rabbeinu Shalom. It's an exact description of our galus. And if we don't feel that we need God, then why in the world should we ever really feel like we need to be or can be connecting meaningfully to God? So these are just some thoughts at the very outset of what I think are some of the contributors to the challenges that we feel in all of the various parts of our community. I think that, therefore, a night like tonight is really exciting to me because we're bringing together many constituents. We have, faculty members of our school here. We have parents in our school. We have, potential parents to our school. We have alumni parents of our school. And we're representing home, school, and community in a very beautiful way. And I hope that we'll be able to open up some meaningful conversation about some theory and some practice in how we can be more mindful in our tefillah and educate ourselves and our children in that way. So I'm actually going to go back. I was calculating today. It really does not feel like it was this long ago, but I guess it's close to 20 years ago. And I imagine to most of you in the room, you're not going to believe that either. But the year was 2001, and I was teaching in this building both the June before and that September. Obviously, that was the month of September 11th, 2001. And I was Baruch Hashem, an established person. I had a large family at that point. I had been married a nice number of years. I'd been teaching a nice number of years. I know all that is scary for me to admit, but yes, it was 20 years ago, and all that was Baruch Hashem true. And I certainly did not feel, I'll use the word vulnerable, but a lot of vulnerability in my life, and frankly, even in my religious life. And then that year was a pretty horrible year, very honestly. It was the year of both the Sbarro bombing, if you remember, it wasn't even the culmination, because unfortunately it didn't end, but it was one of many, many terrorist attacks in the height of the Second Intifada. And it was pre-WhatsApp Tehillim groups, okay? So I found that even though, and my family was relatively young at the time, I found myself going to shul, occasionally to people's homes, but mostly at that point it was shul, with some regularity for a last-minute call to Tehillim group. Either it was for something going on in Eretz Yisrael, or unfortunately there were many people who were ill in our community at that time, and there were constantly this, come, let's come together to say Tehillim. And I embraced those opportunities. I remember my oldest daughter, she must have been like in eighth grade or something, and at a certain point, instead of just leaving her home, I started taking her with me. I said that, maybe this is like a good chinuch kind of experience, but it would be 8, 9 o'clock at night, my kids would be asleep, I'd go out. And I appreciated very much, honestly, having something to do in what felt like really dark times. And at the same time that I very much appreciated having something to do, And frankly, I appreciated gathering together with people who were as solemn as I was and as focused on the news that we had just heard that day, whatever it might be. It's the ghost of SKA and the one printer for production, it looks like. I'm guessing. Okay. I don't think you should stop. No, I think we're okay. Yeah, thank you. I can't say that the actual saying of Tehillim was all that meaningful. I came to the shul, the rabbi, whoever was running the group, said, these are the five prakim that we're saying. We said it. And again, I was very happy for the experience, but it didn't leave its mark on me. And it was starting to bother me a little bit. Like, I started having these images of the shtetl and two generations ago and tear-stained Tehillims and saying, like, what's with me? Like, why is this not really impacting me? Why am I not connecting to it in a very meaningful way? And I kind of knew, because even when I looked, as I said, at the English translation or Baruch Hashem, in many cases, I didn't really need to do that. The words still weren't very meaningful to me. These words, David talking from a cave someplace, or he was talking about nature in a very repetitive way. I like nature, but it wasn't really why I was there that night, right? If I was standing at the Grand Canyon, I could figure out which parak to say. So then I got really excited, and I started looking at different guides. Like, what prakam are you really supposed to say when you're feeling certain things? And frankly, if you've ever looked at those guides, they all say different things. And it's of the 130 prakam, there's about 25 that are repeated over and over again. I'm not sure what happened to the stepbrothers and sisters, but they never seemed to quite make it to the grade. And I still was like not really getting it. And then I probably had one of the most challenging mornings of my professional career, driving into school at 10 to 9 on September 11th. Getting as far as the front desk, the students are in the auditorium, I could spend a whole day repeating what went on there. We had nothing to do but to get the people, first call the students who had parents quickly. No computers gave us that information in a minute. First site who had parents working in the World Trade Center, take them to one area, and then you got to go to class. What are you doing as the second towers are hitting? So what are we doing? Well, I'm an Illuminated Kodesh teacher. We are saying Tehillim, right? And I'm supposed to make this a powerful, meaningful experience, but I'm in my own personal little crisis is too strong a word, but like I'm not, I have recognized pretty profoundly in the last few months that this is not something that I'm connecting all that meaningfully to, and now I'm supposed to transmit that to 15-year-olds in some kind of stage of chaos. I'll come back to the story towards the end and how it resolved itself, but suffice it to say that the general story is that I came out of that with a resolve to try to figure this out. And what I embarked on a journey of that I'm still on, of really trying to understand what tefillah is supposed to mean to us, and most importantly, how we're supposed to be able to impart that to our children and ultimately to our students. I'll jump ahead close to 20 years and say that to some extent, I imagine many of you experienced what I just described even just last week. Last week was a pretty hard week for Klal Yisrael. Really, day after day, tragic news. Again, I'm a little embarrassed to say this. I think it was Thursday morning. I woke up, looked at my phone. I couldn't keep track of which names for Tehillim with which soldiers who were injured which way. I literally had to take out pen and paper and try to, because if I wanted to, update the girls about statuses and who we need to say Tehillim for, it was getting confusing in my mind. Not to mention babies in utero, Nebuch, who, are taken away. And frankly, people in our own community who are struggling very, very deeply in that way. And to some extent, I can say that I feel like I have a much better understanding of tefillah, but I also recognize some 20 years later that I still have a long way to go in trying to make it something which is meaningful and relatable. And I guess it's that journey that I really want to try to share a little bit tonight. The reality is that we need to strengthen our own relationship with tefillah. I needed to as a teacher in a classroom and as a leader of a school. But we're all teachers, and we're all leaders of our families and of our teachers of our children. And if our own connection to tefillah is not strong and isn't actively being developed, then our children are going to be missing out. And I think that's true, actually, for two distinct reasons. If you look at the source sheet, the one that says that starts with the source from Devarim, there's a very interesting conversation about unsuccessful chinuch. That the good news is we're told never happened and never will happen. That's a question in of itself. Involving what's known as the rebellious son. No, he didn't take the car one night without permission. He rebelled really, really badly, known as the Ben Sora Umora. And The discussion of what happens to him takes place in Devarim Perek Chaf Aleph. There's a fascinating pasuk that describes this ben sorer umore, pasuk yichet, ki yel ish ben sorer umore. There is a rebellious son, einenu shomea bekol aviv ubekol imo. He does not listen to either his mother or his father, v'yisaru oto, and they have to discipline him, v'lo yishamea elehem, and he does not listen to them. So there's a repetition in this pasuk that I underlined and highlighted that is something which we take note of any pasuk in Torah, and that is that he doesn't listen is stated twice. What does it mean that, what do we get it? He's rebellious. We assume that means he's not listening to his authority figures. And yet the Torah comes and tells us that he didn't listen twice. So the Munkach Rebbe explains very beautifully that when it describes in the first place, einenu shomea bekol aviv ubekol imo, it goes at length to describe the fact that he's not listening by telling us that he didn't listen both to the voice of his mother and to the voice of his father. And the Munkach Rebbe says that that part of the pasuk is not telling us that he didn't listen to them when they said, don't go there, be home by midnight, text me when you arrive. The not listening to their voice is describing that he didn't hear their voice davening, learning Torah, saying how happy they were to be enjoying mitzvos. He didn't hear their voice, their expression of their connection to the Ribbono Shel Olam. And that it's not describing his rebellion, but rather giving us insight as to why a child might not be inspired in the path in Torah and mitzvos. Because if he's growing up in a home of uninspired parents, and I want to be clear, I'm not suggesting this is the only reason, but it is a contributing factor, or could be a contributing factor, that if a child is not hearing the excited, passionate voice of his parents in learning Torah, in embracing mitzvos, in having sat through the rabbi's shir or speech on Shabbos or whatever it might be, it's not all that likely that he is going to be one who's going to want to follow in that direction of Torah and mitzvos. And therefore, what the Munkach Rebbe is suggesting is that the Parsha of Ben Sorer Umore actually is teaching us how crucially important it is for parents to fuel themselves with spirituality, because they can then be role models to their children. Without that, we are not going to be successful. We look to influence our children, to be mashpiyim on our children. The shorash of the word hashpa'a, Rav Sham Shimon Fal Hirsch explains, is shefa. The people who are influencers are people who overflow themselves with something. If you think about that concept, it is so deep, happens to be an awesome back pocket, like tribute to our Torah. Because anytime somebody has made an impact, it's usually not because they had phenomenal oratory skills or because they even were the most knowledgeable people in a particular area. It's because they overflowed with kindness, with sensitivity. And maybe they overflowed with knowledge as well. That's certainly a possibility. But their impact was felt because they themselves were so full and it was able to spill over to those around them. The sheet which was handed out together with the source sheet is actually from a sefer which is not so well known, but is really a beautiful gem. It's actually the works of Rav Shamshon Rafal Hirsch on Chinuch. We know a lot about Rav Hirsch's Perush al HaTorah, a lot about his discourses on the study of mitzvos. It's a two-sided sheet with four columns. And that, it looks like this. And I'm not going to spend the time to read through it all here now, but I did copy two sides of it that I personally read with some frequency in my role as a parent, primarily. You'll see that's what the discussion is. But Talmidim Kibbonim as well, that basically gives a little potch to parents and says, how do you think you can expect proper midos from your children? They're just watching you like hawks all the time. And if they don't see it from you, if they don't see you davening, I'll never forget my older daughter, who's Baruch Hashem married and a mother now herself. So, you know, honestly, this is also going personal. When my children were young, I can't say I dedicated hours or hours or even minutes or minutes to tefillah on a daily basis. And halachically, it's not incumbent upon us. I never felt terribly guilty about that in any way. But I remember once reminding her ever so gently and looking the other way, not looking how much she davened, but Sunday, did you daven? Before we go shopping, don't forget to daven. And just like over her shoulder, and those of you who know her, she's the sweetest, sweetest. She's like, yeah, I'm just curious, when do you daven? And I was like, oh boy, right? Okay. And if I did do it quickly up in my room, you bet it started happening downstairs. And maybe it wasn't even any longer. But the reality that it was important, right, that if I expected that to be of her, and I want to be clear, we can ask things of our children that we don't do. You know, it doesn't work that way when I tell them they have to clean their rooms and the cleaning lady cleaned mine. I don't buy into it there at all. But the point is that they are looking at us all the time, right? And they are noticing what we do and what we don't do. And Rav Hirsch raises this point in a very strong way as being one of the most crucial reasons why we need to be fueling our tank, why we need to be thinking, in this case, for our topic tonight about our own tefillah, if we want our children to be stimulated in their tefillah. On the bottom of his page 44, he just writes, "What a magnificent but solemn moment it is when the Holy One entrusts the soul of a newborn baby to the care of the father and mother. The Creator expects that the parents will attend not only to the child's physical needs, but also to his education. It is the parents' responsibility to see that the newborn develops into a moral, upright human being. This momentous and demanding task belongs only to parents." And he, obviously, we believe that schools play a large role. That's why we're here tonight, without a question. But I do want to make the point that sometimes we could feel that things like this belong in the domain only of the school. And the reality is that our children learn most from us and understand most from our own examples. The rest of it will be, I think, interesting reading for yourself in that way. In addition to this role modeling concept, over the last number of years, I've given a lot of thought to how do we nurture spirituality? How do we cultivate spirituality? Again, these are things I've thought about within my own family, within my own self, and obviously for my students as well. And obviously, Yaldus has a lot to say about this. Our Bali Musar, Rav Volbi in particular, has much to discusses at great length. What are some of the key ingredients to nurturing and cultivating spirituality in ourselves and in our children? And honestly, there have been a lot of English books written about it. There's a lot out there, and there's a lot to be discussed. In 2015, there's a fascinating book that was produced by a woman by the name of Lisa Miller. Lisa Miller is not religious. She is a traditional Jew. The name of the book is The Spiritual Child. It really shot up quickly on the New York Times bestseller list. And it is a scientific study of how spirituality across religions is nurtured. It is one of those books, and some of you know me well this way, that is tabbed in at least 100 places. Because as you read it, you are reading Torah thought and Mamre Chazal left, right, and center, supported by scientific study. If you're into this stuff, I highly, highly recommend it. But after I read the book and started to really analyze so many of the parallels and so many of the things that we have understood all of these years from Chazal, I came up with a little terminology for myself that I had the opportunity to share with SKA teachers, but honestly have never really shared beyond that small group before. And that is that when we think about developing spirituality, we often talk in education about the three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic. But I think if we think about it, there are three R's in cultivating spirituality. And they are relationship, reflection, and relevance. They're all outlined in a short way on the sheet. And I want to just take a few minutes to discuss how these things actually relate, particularly to tefillah, to share some things, like I said, from some of these studies, and some things clearly originate from Chazal. In her book, Lisa Miller talks a lot about relationships being a key part in developing spirituality. And if you think about it, Chazal in the Gemara in Kiddushin, a very, very famous Gemara, taught us that there are shlosha shutvim ba'adam. There are three partners in the creation of man. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Aviv, V'imo. There is God, there is the person's father, and the person's mother. These are the three partners in the creation of man. And then the Gemara goes on to teach us, Bizman sha'adam mechabed et aviv et imo, amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, ma'ala ani aleihem ki'ilu darti b'neihem v'kabduni. That when a person engages in acts of kibud av'eim, shows honor and respect to his parents, HaKadosh Baruch Hu sees it as if they're honoring God. Because when a child is able to see outside of himself, that's already a little bit of a chiddush, and is able to recognize needs of others and authority of others. Those are giant steps in recognizing that there is somebody, an entity outside of yourself, i.e. God, and that there is a need, that we need God, and that we have an obligation to respect God in a similar way that we do our parents. The Gemara in Kiddushin implies that actually part of the reason why there's even a mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Em is purely to cultivate spirituality. That there should be a stepping stone, there should be the ability to see outside of yourself in the areas of kavod and yira, of honor and of respect. Lisa Miller writes, our natural spirituality is closely allied with human bonding, creating relational spirituality or the experience of transcendence through relationships with one another, with a higher power, and within ourselves. That we will feel more spiritual when we have meaningful relationships with others. Because that in itself reminds us that there is an other in the world, and it models for us what that relationship can be. She writes very powerfully later on in the book, the connection was clear and strong. An unconditionally loving and reliable parent, mother or father, was associated with a strongly felt sense of an always present, accepting, and loving God. The nature of an individual's daily lived relationship with a higher power, particularly the way they understand, struggle with, and resolve suffering, was strongly affected by the parenting they had received. What she does is she develops the idea in the Gemara, and I think the Tanaim developed this as well. But in simple English, she develops the idea a little bit further. She says that when we have a relationship with a parent, and that relationship has its ups and downs, but there is an unconditional love that is given by the parent, that is showing and modeling to the child that there is a concept of an authority figure who you might struggle with, who you might sometimes want to run away from, and sometimes you might want to run towards. But that figure is somebody who we can have a relationship with, and similar to the relationship that we just described can be that with a parent, that same relationship can be found within the Ribono Sholem himself. So I'd like to suggest that based on some of these comments, our role as parents is not just as role model in our own tefillah and in our own spirituality, but by being parents who love unconditionally, who can forgive, who can look at people's good parts, recognize their negativity, their weaknesses, give tochacha, but show that we believe in people's ability to move forward and be better people, we are actually acting B'Tselem Elokim. We're acting like the Ribono Sholem, and that very role of parent is one which has been proven to be a stepping stone to developing a relationship with God himself. And therefore, the first of the three R's is actually developing that relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. When it comes to the second one, reflection, I could, again, talk about each one of these for hours and hours on end. I chose not to bring any sources, but actually just to raise two very important points. One is something which we hear all the time, but unfortunately, at least I have not yet figured out how to create in a very systematic way in my life or that of my family or students. And that is, we live in a world where we're bombarded by stimuli. We rarely have time to think, and certainly not to think for ourselves. And it's very hard to talk about a relationship with an abstract being, God, if we never ever think about what that means. But I'm going to take it a step further, and I think this is also something to think about, was a time where I actually had to take a hard right-hand turn myself. And that is that there is a lot of conversation. What was particularly striking to me, another book, which I, a much more intellectual book, honestly, it's the name of the book is, forgetting it right now, by Jeremy Kagan. I think it's To Be a Jew is the, no, that's not something else. Something to be. I'm forgetting the name of it right now. But he discusses actually very vividly in the book the fact that we do not live in a world where we talk about God a lot. And that where conversation about God is virtually absent. So I will tell you that I was mentioning that on any of these educator blogs and people post things, have you ever taught you know, medieval Jewish history using slides, you know, where can you find good things and stuff like that. So tefillah is often a topic. And in one of these threads where everybody was kind of saying, well, this is the problem with tefillah, and that's the problem with tefillah, and this is what we should do, and this is the solution, et cetera, et cetera. There was a suggestion made, and this, again, goes back many, many years ago. Well, the problem is that we don't talk about God. I glanced at it, and I moved on. I said, that doesn't apply to us. You know, we're a yeshiva. We talk about God all the time, right? And there was a lot of talk about it, and people were saying yes, and people were saying no, and it kind of was getting very distracting. Like, that was, like, became, like, the obsessive topic, and I was just, like, totally uninterested. And then a kind of a light bulb went off in my head, and I said to myself, do we really talk about God? And we say Baruch Hashem sometimes. We say Emir Hashem. Maybe we kiss the mezuzah. I read psukim all day long that say Vayomer Hashem al Moshe lemor. But do we really talk about God? And I really started to actually gauge myself, and then I started asking some of my colleagues, and conversations about a relationship with God, or what God means to me, or where do we feel God, are really not prevalent, I'll admit, even in our very wonderful yeshiva high school as of a few years ago. I will say that on January 1st, we're having a Yom Iyun on the topic of Emunah. That came actually out of conversations with teachers and this realization that we don't talk enough about the existence of God. I don't even mean philosophical proofs for the existence of God. We don't do enough of that either. I really mean about talking about God, God being part of our vernacular in a meaningful way, in a way that makes it something that we can actually have a relationship with. And if we're never talking about something, we certainly can never reflect on it. And if we can't reflect on it, then it's very hard to suggest that we can have a relationship with God. The third of the R's that I want to focus on is actually that of relevance. And with this, I want to touch on two points and then hopefully share some practical experience. When we talk about relevance in light of tefillah and with a relationship with God, I think there are two different ways that we can look at relevance. The first is something which is described in the piece that I excerpted here on the second side. It's from Rabbi Chaim Strachler, who's a rabbi in Toronto. And again, it's from a blog post from a number of years ago. But he was actually lamenting, again, the problem of spirituality in our communities. And he was actually comparing davening in particular to a baseball game. And he says, everyone's telling me, shul's too long, Rabbi, we got to cut it, it's too boring, we got to make it more exciting. And he started to think one Sunday when he was at a baseball game with his son, this is really boring. And it's actually, the shortest it ever is as long as shul on Shabbos morning. And sometimes it goes into extra innings, it could be much longer than three Sifrei Torah being taken out. It can be really long. And yet, there are hundreds of thousands of people mesmerized and riveted by this really slow-moving game. And he started to ask himself, why is it that people are so engaged? And he doesn't use the word relevance, but when you read this excerpt, and if you choose to, I encourage you to read the whole blog at a point where you might have some time, he actually says because they're familiar with the rhythms of the game. When the pitcher winds up ever so slowly, I remember, I grew up with three brothers, I have many sons. Half the time I look at these things, I'm sure it's in slow-mo, and this is before slow-mo existed. Like, could we please move this along? And the reality is that he discusses, he writes, I bolded it, right? Is that, I'm sorry, in the paragraph before that, above that, to develop a love for baseball, you need to feel the rhythms of the game. You need to inhabit the battle of the mind between the pitcher and the batter. The split second that a fielder jumps as the ball comes off the bat, and the ponderous decisions that face a manager late in the game. You see, if you feel the rhythms, if you know what's happening next, it's actually not so boring. If you are in it, if you know what's going on around you, why the aron's being open, what's coming out, why we're standing, why we're sitting, that anticipation of what's coming next is something that alleviates that boredom greatly. The chief tool for developing an emotional connection toward anything is investing time in it. Ironically, to develop an emotional connection to baseball, a prayer ritual and rote performance are essential ingredients. And this is an important point that I just wanted to touch upon tonight. Again, it's a conversation in and of itself. But the point that he makes is some of the things that we find annoying about tefillah, the rote and the ritual, if I could use my own language, actually gives it relevance to us. We know what's going to happen next. It's that feeling that people who travel around the world tell you that they can go into a shul in Morocco and so many things can look different. The ornaments can look different and the what the Sefer Torah looks like can look different. But then at the end, they're singing Adon Olam and they know what to expect and they feel in it. If our children do not learn the rhythms of tefillah, if they are not exposed in a rote manner to the rituals of tefillah, it will never feel relevant to them. Too many of our children feel alien in a shul. They don't feel comfortable. And why would you ever want to engage meaningfully in tefillah if you don't feel in it, if you feel like a stranger, if you don't know what page they're on, if you don't know when to put down the sitter and pick up the chumash? These are some of our rhythms, and to feel connected, we have to feel its relevance. Now, that's perhaps not the typical way to explain relevance, but I think it's an important one, and I'm going to move to a different suggestion for relevance as well, one which is probably more on your mind, and that is that the words of our tefillot have to feel relevant. And here now I come back to my own personal journey, where honestly, they didn't always feel relevant, and at times still, for newer tefillot to me, don't always feel relevant. And I think it's an important conversation to have, how we can make tefillah feel more relevant, how on that morning of September 11th, and unfortunately many other mornings and afternoons since, I have been forced, for myself personally, and for whether it's my own family or for my students, to try to make the words of tefillah feel more relevant. So I want to share with you a little bit of that journey and share with you some practical applications of how that third R relevance to the words can be so incredibly powerful. So I left the classroom left the school building very late that day, went through what I'm sure many of the rest of you went through for the next couple of days and weeks post 9/11. If you remember, it was Erev Rosh Hashanah. We were thrown right into the Yemei Hadin. And it was after Sukkot that I could not get out of my mind this feeling of Ad Kan. I got to figure this out, and I got to make sense of tefillah for myself personally. And I decided to embark on learning about Tehillim. Much of our tefillot come from Tehillim. I'm a Tanakh teacher. And I was asked at that time to give a shiur in the community in Tanakh on an ongoing basis. And I am so lucky that I can take personal advantage of my professional responsibilities. And I said, okay, ladies, if you want to learn something, we're learning Tehillim. I did not at the time give all the background as to why. But this was really my personal journey, which I shared with a few people around the dining room table. And I started with the Hakdama to Sefer Tehillim by the Malbim, and I was my frustration was rising. The Malbim Hakdama is stunning. Again, at another time, something gorgeous to learn together. But he basically, in a nutshell, says Tehillim is a beautiful treasure chest with pearls and diamonds and jewels, and we hold them so tightly, and they sparkle in our crown. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm the worst Jew ever. This is not helping me, and I am not really feeling much connection in a deep way. And then as I continued moving through some sources, general commentary about Tehillim, I came across a comment from a Rabbi Yudan in the Medrash on Tehillim. And Rabbi Yudan says the following, that everything that David HaMelech said, he said, Kinegdo, Kineged Kol Yisrael, the Kineged Kol Ha'itim. Yes, when David HaMelech was writing his Mizmor LeDavid, he was writing it about his own life. But when he was writing it, says the Medrash, he wasn't just writing about his own life. He was writing it for all of Klal Yisrael at that time and at all times. Okay. I'm still feeling really disenfranchised because you may have had that intention, David HaMelech, many years ago, but I'm living a lot longer later and this is not relating to me at all. I'm still missing the boat. And I remember very clearly preparing for this particular shiur, the opening shiur, and saying to myself, let me just switch the topic. I wasn't anti, but if I'm not passionate, if I'm not feeling it, like I can't be sharing things and saying over these beautiful words that aren't really registering with me and resonating with me in a way. So I do what I often do, which is I close it. I'm sure many of you do this. Said, let me wake up in the morning and see what it's, you know, if I feel any better about it. Of course, it wasn't the next morning. It was probably the night before that I had to actually give the share, that I, you know, went back to it in some way. But then it came to me in an epiphany, a mashal that I'm going to share with you that perhaps I've shared with some of you at other points, because very honestly, it's one of the very few things that I think about with real regularity. And I credit my mother-in-law very much, as you'll see in a minute. And I actually, on my way here, called her and said, Ma, I don't know if I ever even told you about this, and I hadn't. So I thank you all for tonight that I had the opportunity to share something with her that she inspired me with. I kept thinking to myself, this statement from a Yudan, like, does that ever work? Is there ever anything where somebody says for themselves, for the whole nation, and for all times? Like, that's so unrealistic. And I was like digging myself deeper and deeper and deeper into my vindictiveness of like, I'm not crazy, but this is not realistic. And then it hit me that there is a multi-billion-dollar industry, which, like many, is probably going to go down the tubes in our age of technology. But the greeting card industry is an amazing, amazing industry. And I always often marvel at these things, like how brilliant people are when they come up with these things. But buying cards is a little bit of a, you know, dying pastime. But those of you who still do it, I, Baruch Hashem, have the opportunity to buy many Mother's Day cards on Erev Mother's Day. I have a grandmother, Baruch Hashem, mother-in-law, a mother, a daughter who's a mother. There could be 5 or 6 cards that I'm buying for at the same time. It is never, it's not one of those things I say it's going to take me 2 minutes. I know it's going to be time in that aisle. And I stand, you know, like this. They're like fanned out. Like, you don't get them confused. My grandmother's card is my grandmother's. My daughter's is my daughter's. My mother's is my mother's. My mother, and they're all beautiful. But till I find each one and put it in its place, it's very, very particular. And when I get that, hold that card, I say to myself, this is my mother. I got it. Perfect. This one, and sometimes I'll exchange. I'll think I got a good one, and it isn't so good. I got a better one. This one is it. And then it occurred to me that there are like 10 of them in that stack. So that means that there are other people coming into this CVS, into the aisle, maybe even right next to me, holding the same card. I'm like, your mother and my mother? Hard to believe that, okay? But with that same excitement, they're holding that card, and they are saying, this is my mother. Then I started thinking, this card's been translated into many languages. There are people of all sorts of socioeconomic groups all over the world holding this card saying, this is my mom right now. It's not my grandmother, and it's not my mother-in-law. This is my mom. Because the card was written by somebody, Kenegdo, Keneged, Kol Ha'am, Ukeneged Kol Ha'itim. I don't really believe these cards have changed all that much, right, in the last 50, 60, however long Hallmark has been there. But why is that? How does that work? I brought a little show and tell with my mother-in-law's permission. Because anybody else have people that do this? If you can see underlinings. She loves Yacinelli, okay? But that's other than that, okay? And my mother-in-law, and those of you who know my mother-in-law, most awesome woman, okay? But this is definitely very much her style. But honestly, I have a grandmother that does the same thing. I have a sister-in-law that does the same thing. They're not related to each other, by the way, any of those people. You have single underlinings, double underlinings, carrot tops, little words inserted, right? Because what was happening when you were standing in that aisle was you were mentally doing all of that. So some people do it in action, and some people do it mentally. Some people say, when I say to you all the great times we've had together, you and I both know what that means, right? We're not just talking about lots of times. We're talking about those 3 or 4 long DMCs that you really got me through something, and we know it. So there's an underlining, there's a parenthesis, there's a carrot top that's happening there. And that's why it can apply in so many ways, because there's relevance. We make the card relevant because we have a relationship and because we reflect on the relationship and on the words and how they can be relevant to us and to other people. Or we buy a box of greeting cards, which we sometimes do. We got to quickly write out the thank you notes, the whatever it is, the, you know, the happy holidays with the tip, whatever it might be. We quickly just write, dear so-and-so, love so-and-so, seal it, send it. That's a communication also. But there's a big difference between the first type of card shopping and the second. And it all has to do with the three R's, with the relationship, with the reflection, and with the making relevant the text that you are saying. When David HaMelech wrote Sefer Tehillim, he was more brilliant and a bigger multi-billionaire than any of the Hallmark company, because he wrote a Sefer where we can actually do that every single time we read it. Because we can take one perek of Tehillim and we can create our own underlinings, our own carrot tops, our own parentheses. We need to have the relationship. We need to know who we're directing the Tehillim to and who we're saying it to. And we have to have spoken about God. He has to be somebody who we're in touch with in some way, shape, or form for us to be sending it. Otherwise, it's the anonymous super in the building. And again, it gets there. It does the trick. But it's not going to be nearly as meaningful. And we have to also be able to understand how what we're saying is relevant to us. What you have in front of you is one sample perek. And I kind of chose a Benoni perek. It's not one of the super famous ones, but it's one of the ones that we say with some frequency, Kuf Mem Bet. And I want to just share with you a little bit how this works. It sounds like this is crazy, and this, you know, this takes so much time, and who has time to do this? I promise you that it's one of those tools. It's like an organizing tool that once it becomes part of your repertoire, it's seconds. It like clicks like this to make it happen. And it's unbelievably transformative. What you do is that in the beginning of a perek of Tehillim, there is almost always a variable subject. In this case, I will call it the Ma'ara. This is Mizmor LeDavid Be'Oto Ma'ara Tzfila. This is the very perek that I might have looked at 20 years ago and said, skip it. We live in buildings. We don't live in caves. But when you think about it, even for David HaMelech, even historically, it's very hard to figure out what this perek is referring to. He was in a Ma'ara more than once. And even for David, it's somewhat vague about which Ma'ara experience it is. But a Ma'ara can mean so many things, just like great time spent together can mean so many things. And for some people, a Ma'ara is a place of loneliness. For some people, it's a tunnel without being able to see the light clearly at the end. A tunnel of what? Maybe it's of financial stress. Maybe it's of illness. Maybe it's of wondering what's going to be politically with the state of Israel. Or maybe it's just not knowing what we can do to help one of our own children. We feel like we're in a Ma'ara of sorts. I was just thinking about it tonight, and this is the first time it ever occurred to me. For some, a Ma'ara is actually a place of safety. If you were in a war, in a battlefield, then being in the Ma'ara would actually be the place where you feel most safe and most covered at that time. So whoever you are, Kol Yisrael, and whatever time you're in, so it could be me saying it today, but I'm saying it at a different time tomorrow. It could be me in 2018. It could be my great-grandmother with a tear-stained Tehillim in Europe in 1930. It's all the same perek, but what the Ma'ara means will mean a different thing to each and every one of us. But here's where it gets exciting to me. Not only do I give a definition to the word Ma'ara, but once I've given a definition to the word Ma'ara, illness, financial distress, protection, darkness, loneliness, whatever that is, I can now use that definition to define, these are the words that I chose to bold, but you may find other variables, the other variables in the rest of the perek. You see, one of the things that was so disenfranchising to me about Tehillim was that it never said anything. It was always so general. A little trivia, the word holy appears in Sefer Tehillim twice. 130 Prakim, twice, right? What? Like, that seems ridiculous. Because there's nothing specific at Tehillim. That's why all of those guides of what to say when cross over in so many different ways. Because in all honesty, L'kol Yisrael, L'kol Ha'itim. Tehillim is meant to be vague because it's meant to be universal. But for it to have meaning, you have to make it relevant to yourself in some way. So once I have a definition for my word ma'ara, now I know what my kol is el Hashem. My voice to Hashem is actually a voice of despair, illness, poverty, whatever it might be. This happens to be a parak which talks mostly in the negative crying. You'll see at the end it gets better. But that's why I'm using so many negative examples. Clearly there are other prakim where it's easier to see it as celebratory. And the same thing would be about in the next line, sihi, what my conversation is. What is my tzara? If I never define what my tzara is for what I'm saying this in my head, then it's not going to have meaning. But if I have a particular tzara in mind, then what? All of a sudden, the perek becomes alive and very full. And the same thing goes as I go down through the rest of the perek for all of the underlined words. Hatzileni, I'm just skipping down to the second to last pasuk. Hatzileni mi rotfai. Rotfai is not my physical enemies, right? Rotfai doesn't, I'm not a victim of bullying who's being chased down the block right now. But rotfai might be cancer cells. Rotfai might be the collector, the debtor, whoever it might be. Rotfai might be my own anxiety, right? Can chase after me and make it difficult for me to function. We have so many things that pursue us and stop us and stumble us and get us in the way of who we can be in our best possible ways. But we need to give relevance to each and every one of these words. And lastly, at the end of the perek, Hotzia mi mazger, take me out from my prison, whatever's holding me back. Maybe it's social inhibition, right? Doesn't even have to be so dramatic. Or for high school girls, that's very dramatic, right? But it can be anything. I'm scared to call and invite somebody for Shabbos. Maybe they'll say no, right? These are real things. And that can be something that's a prison to us. And we end the parak by focusing on ki tigmal alai for all of the things that you do to champion and to help me be the best that I can be, your gracious dealings with me. What I'd like to suggest we do in conclusion this evening is to actually take a moment to think about the perek, to then say the perek together. I think it's incredibly powerful to be in a room of many women and to know that there will be many kavanot for this perek that will be deeply personal, that do not need to be shared in any public way, but that will be a true fulfillment of recognizing our vulnerabilities, our need for a relationship with the Ribbono Shalom, the first of the three R's, to take a minute to reflect on what it is that we have to be asking him for, and to try to look at the relevance in those underlined words towards that topic, and allow the perek to connect to us in the most meaningful of ways. I know that I personally will very much be taking the opportunity to look for a refuah shalema for Masha Hinda Bas Malka Rosa, a woman who means a lot to many of us in the room, both personally and honestly, has been a tremendous friend of SKA and is very much in need of our tfilos at this particular time. I'll give everybody just a minute or two to look at the words one time to themselves, and then we'll say the perek together. We can stand and say together, Parakuf Membet. We won't do it responsively, but we'll do it together. Maskil David Beyoto Bemarat Vila. Koli El Adonai Ezak Koli El Adonai Echanan. Eshpoch Lefanav Sichi Sarati Lefanav Agid. Behitatef Alai Ruchi Vata Yadata. Nisi Votai Beorach Zu Atalech Tamnu Pachli. Habet Yamin Ure Veinli Makir. Avad Manos Mimeni Ein Doresh Lenafshi. Za'akti elecha Hashem, amarti ata machzi chelki be'eretz hachayim. Hakshiva el rinati, ki daloti ma'od, hatzileni me'rodfai, ki amtsu mimen. Hotzia mimazger nafshi lehodot et shemecha, bi'achtiru tzadikim, ki tigmol alai. May all of our tefillos be answered, and may we have the zchus to continue to cultivate our own spirituality and the spirituality of our children, and to hopefully elevate tefillah in our personal lives and in our community lives as well. Thank you.